next case is case number 67955, Gordon versus Geiger. We have Ms. Cowden for the appellant, Mr. Pepperman for the respondent. Did you want to reserve some time for the 15 minutes?
Yes, please. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes. Please, the court. My name is Tammy Cowden. I'm here on behalf of Jennifer Geiger, and also present in the courtroom is an individual who was her fiancé at the time of the below. He is now her husband, and it's very desirous back here. Also known as Motsi. So if I mention Motsi, that's who I'm referring to. I'd like to thank the court on behalf of Ms. Geiger for moving the date of our argument. I hadn't expected that would result in our arguing here, but we do appreciate the argument being moved from Reno down here so that she can be present. I think it has to be clear to this court that the procedures that occurred below were definitely out of place. This court, in fact, subsequently adopted rules to require the family courts to actually comply with a longstanding law of NRS 50.500, which refers to the alternative testimony by children.
So before you go down that road, can we have you begin with just the position of the case? We originally had before the court a motion as to changing or enhancing the custody that your client had. And there was an oral representation from the father as to his custody. Why don't you talk about that, that then bleeds over to the issue that you wanted to start with?
Okay, well, the issue that was actually raised in the trial court was a motion to change custody by mother based upon an arrest of father while the children were in his custody. They were not, I believe, present at the time of the arrest, but they were in his physical custody at the time. And there was also matters of father was requesting a decrease in his child support. Father had not requested any changes in his, he was opposing a change of custody, but he was not requesting any increase in his parenting time.
So the motion practice was a motion to reduce or extinguish father's visitation and father's opposition and counter motion to reduce or extinguish child support. Is that what was the written?
That's basically true. It was actually to require the visitation with father to be supervised.
Okay.
Rather than reduced or eliminated.
Okay.
But to be supervised, and as I said, to change legal custody from joint custody to mother.
Okay.
That was the procedural posture, and I will confess that as I said, the other issue was pretty straightforward, so it did occur to me that perhaps the lack of notice, the lack of due process notice is what made this an en banc issue. Yes, it's very clear. This was not, there was no notice prior to the hearing, unless you count, the minute before the hearing started, that any issue related to a reduction of mother's time or even removing custody from mother to father would ever be raised in this hearing. There was no notice to mother prior to the date of the hearing itself. that there had been any allegations of any, the purported punch, she had no knowledge of this. The information that is in the record regarding those issues comes solely from the judge herself. And, going back to other reasons, that in itself is error, reversible error. The judge was the only witness who brought this evidence to the court.
And counsel, I think, as Justice Douglas pointed out, I think we're real concerned about that. And if a motion isn't filed seeking to modify the decree to adjust the custody and all like that, can you, of course, sua sponte, go into an evidentiary hearing? I'll be interested in what opposing counsel says there. Does it have to be noticed, by way of motion to modify it in order for the court even to consider it then?
Well, certainly that's what, prior rulings of this court have certainly held that. Mm-hmm. There's no question in that regard that you are required to have, it's just a general due process issue. You're required to give notice of what the issues are so a party is prepared to respond to the issues. This court had that in, I have to look through my notes, I'm sorry. Wallace v. Wallace, obviously, Moser v. Moser. Those were both issues in which custody and visitation were involved, and there hadn't been adequate notice given. And this, in both of those cases, this court said that a lack of notice required that the matter be reheard. But yes, that's very clear.
Are you arguing that the consent to, and leave aside the legal issues about whether the child interview could have been consented to, but are you arguing that the consent was contextually specific to the motion the mother brought? Is there any argument that expanding it to a broader issue that wasn't noticed invalidated the consent to the court's in-chambers interview of the child?
To the extent that consent could ever be considered consent, that her agreement to one of the two options given by the court, both of which were unlawful, yes, it was limited to those issues. The assumption was the issues that she had raised, that he was taking the boys hunting, therefore indicating that he had weapons, that as a parolee as a convicted felon he was not entitled to have. That was one of the issues, whether he had taken the children out of state without permission. Those were the types of issues that there was an expectation that would be considered in the interview.
So the timeline was a written motion, and then the court said it was going to interview the children. When did it, on the timeline, come into the record that the children had reported, or one of the children had reported to the court having been punched?
Okay, there was the motion filed to change custody and change to supervised visitation. There was a hearing in August. Ms. Gordon was not represented at that hearing. And at that hearing, there were allegations that she had somehow engineered the arrest of Mr. Geiger. And the court later indicated that its purpose of setting a later evidentiary hearing was to determine those issues, among others. Although I don't think the children would have been.
Right, that's part of the disconnect.
But so the court said at that time, I'm inclined, those are her words, I'm inclined, and she actually said, I'm inclined to interview, interrupted herself, and I'm inclined to have them interviewed. And then gave the choice, I will interview them, or the Family Mediation Center will interview them. She then set a hearing for approximately 30 days down the road. It ended up being about 45, closer to 45. And with the idea that that interview would occur in the meantime, and each side was also instructed to produce further briefing on the existing issues, which is exactly what occurred.
on the date of the hearing, that is when the bundle showed his truck.
The later evidentiary.
The later evidentiary hearing in October, yes.
Okay.
That is when, apparently immediately before the hearing started, counsel were permitted to look at the CPS reports, which were never placed in the record, and apparently were informed at that time that the judge was considering removing custody from Ms. Jordan. But then when they proceeded with the hearing, which hearing addressed entirely the issues that had actually been briefed?
Now, should
in the end, when the judge, and I'm sorry, I interrupted someone, I think.
Finish your statement, I'll ask the question.
The evidence that was presented was finished in terms of the witnesses that the parties had brought. It was all addressed to the issues that had been briefed. And then the judge said, you know, put on the record her recollection of what she had read in the reports and what she had, the statements during her interview. And that was, like I said, that's the first notice to Ms. Ford.
And was your client represented at the evidentiary hearing?
At the evidentiary hearing, yes, she was represented.
And was there any objection to the district court statement of what, or the lack of notice of the interjection of those issues into the...
Well, there was no objection pursuant to, you know, Rule 50, to NRS 50. But certainly there were attempts to, for Ms. Gordon to suggesting that there should be, you know, basically more evidentiary proceedings occur, that there should be I don't practice family law, so I apologize, but it was some sort of focused inquiry that appeared to be a term of art in the family law practice, and which I gather would probably be a custody of what from my practice in another state would have been called a custody evaluation.
In this particular matter, you reference the CPS information, good, bad, and different. Is that enough for the court to look at the best interest of the child in terms of wanting to have a Rule 50 examination of the children?
Well, first of all, she didn't have the CPS reports before she ordered the interview. But without those CPS reports being in the record, I don't know what's in them. None of you do. She doesn't. I don't believe they do. We don't know what's actually in those reports. I can't tell you whether it's enough. I don't know. It's not in the record.
Now, to your way of thinking in terms of this Rule 50, because they use terms of art, you talk about this talk in terms of the examination of a child witness versus, quote, interviewing the witness. The judge said she interviewed the witness in chambers. Is there a distinction, or is it one and the same? And should Rule 50 apply or not apply? And do we need the findings if it applies?
Well, the NRS 50.500, it talks about alternative forms of testimony, and it actually defines the alternative forms means something other than testimony given in open court with an opportunity to cross-examine in the presence of the parties. So anything that is an alternative to that is what is covered by NRS 50.
The concern was that later on when the judge comes on the record and talks about what they understood, do we have a record of that examination or that interview with the children to understand how the questions were put forth and responded to? Were they neutral questions? Were they yes or no questions?
That is precisely the problem, Your Honor. We don't have that record. There is absolutely nothing in the record. We don't know. We have to assume the court asked the children questions. I mean, I can kind of piece together what may have happened here based upon, you know, reading between lines in the record. I know why the CPS reports were made. It's because of an issue that was actually involving Matsi and his first wife, and their custody disputes. And it was apparently, again, this is my guess, statements by those children that purportedly
confirmed the punch. And my guess, that's where the term, the word punch actually originated. Now, did the judge ask her, Weston, is this true? Or did he ask more generally and he volunteered a statement? And did he actually use the word punch? We have no way of knowing because it's not in the record. And that's exactly the sort of thing that NRS 50.500 is supposed to prevent by requiring a specific model when you do use alternative forms. And also, further, there took, you know, this was a 12-year-old. This was not a very young child who might have difficulty articulating. This was a 12-year-old who could, I'm sure, have, you know, been perfectly fine testifying in court. Or you know, even if it were in a more protected environment, so that it wasn't in open court, but certainly...
Ms. Cowden, is NRS 5500 waivable by the parties?
Pursuant to the rule adopted by this court, it is waivable if the parties are fully informed of its existence and requirements. The statute itself uses mandatory language, so it's not clear to me that the legislature actually intended it to be waivable.
It's a uniform act. Is there law one way or the other? I didn't see it in the briefs on whether this uniform act can be waived.
I will confess that was something I should have looked into, Your Honor.
Okay, I'm not grilling you. Do you know?
I do not know. I'm sorry.
Okay. Thank you.
And I'll give you 2 minutes in rebuttal, and I'll give you 17 minutes. 17 minutes, Mr. Peppermint.
Thank you very much, Jim.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Eric Peppermint. I'm here on behalf of Mr. Geiger. His wife, Debbie, is also present in the courtroom. It's a pleasure and honor to be here on the first official day of this courtroom, which is a wonderful building. But picking up on one thing that was said earlier was everything about this punch came from the judge in this case. And that is incorrect. That is not accurate. Everything about this punch came from the children.
How do we know that, counsel?
Or it came from the interview, as recounted by the judge.
How do we know, as recounted by the judge?
That is correct.
Was the interview recorded?
It was not recorded.
Do we know what questions the judge, how they queried the children?
We do not know how the judge questioned.
What we have is the judge's interpretation.
We have the judge interviewing the children pursuant to a stipulation between the parties, and then...
And did the judge follow the children witness rule? Did they make a finding of any kinds of findings as to why they should do what they're doing?
Well, the judge followed the law with respect to the interview because it was pursuant to a stipulation by the parties. The judge did not make the findings under the Uniform Child Testimony Act because there was no need to make those findings.
Can that be waived?
Can the requirements of the rule be waived?
Yes.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Do you have any case law to that?
Well, in Nevada, there is no case law on whether the...
Any other jurisdiction you can give us?
The jurisdiction that I came across was, or the case that I came across at this point in was the Benjamin v. Benjamin case. And that was a Supreme Court of Missouri case, and it's three...
Is that a Uniform Act case?
No, the issue was slightly different there. What happened was they were asking whether to qualify the child as a witness. And instead of qualifying the child in open court, the judge interviewed the child in chambers and came out and said, no, I'm not qualifying this child as a witness. On appeal, the objection was, the district court qualified the child as a witness, not on the record, it's not recorded, we don't know what the questions were, we don't know what was said or what was done. And the Supreme Court, or I believe it was a appellate court in Missouri, said, Well, you're right. This was probably not the right way to handle it. That probably was push come to shove a legal error. However, by looking at the facts, this happened. And the judge took the child into chambers and interviewed the child and came out and said, the child doesn't qualify as a witness. And the court said there was no objection to that. It was apparently agreed to between the parties because the judge asked, I'm gonna do this if it's okay with everyone, and no one said anything.
What is your site, your Missouri site?
It is 370 Southwest 2nd, 639, and that's a 1963 case. And so that is what brings us back to this case, is what is the substantial evidence that supports this court's the district court's orders in this case? And that is, one, the interview, and two, the statements in the CPS records.
Counsel, Justice Hardesty, I think, earlier asked opposing counsel, is there provisions within the statute for waiver of the requirements?
Is there a provision in the statute for waiver? Yes, Your Honor, there is. And I'll direct your attention to NRS 50.560 subsection 2, where it specifically states that the provisions of NRS 50.500 to 50.620 inclusive do not preclude in a non-criminal proceeding any other procedure permitted by law for a child witness to testify. So we have any other procedure.
It does not it require that the other provisions, some kind of findings on the record of why you're doing what you're doing? It just doesn't waive all the procedures.
Well, I think you do, that's when all this comes into play, is to say you make these findings if there's a dispute, if there's a question, if there's an objection on the record to say, hey, I don't think we should allow this child to be interviewed this way, or I don't think this is the proper procedure to follow, then I think these procedures absolutely apply. I think the court should hold a hearing and take evidence and make the determinations that are stated in NRS 50.570 to say, this is why I find that this is an appropriate way to interview or to have these children testify as through an interview.
Is there any waiver of requirements, since this is child testimony, that it not be memorialized in some fashion on the record?
Well, I think if you look at the statute where it talks about the definition of an alternative method,
is it alternative method as to how the inquiry is made, or is it a alternative method of how you have a recordation of what is taking place during that alternative examination?
Well, it's an alternative method of how the testimony is obtained. The statute says nothing about recording the interview.
But even if, I mean, just logically, if you have an off-the-record interview between a judicial officer and a child, and then you want to put the testimony into the record as evidence, how does it come in as evidence at that point?
Well, I think it's
I mean, the judge was not sworn. The judge is saying this is what the child told me. So
right.
You don't have any recordation, so you have that problem, but you also have an enormous hearsay problem.
Well, I think that you have, I think it's the same thing, and this gets into the CPS records, is with the CPS records, is or
when the CPS records say the charge was unsustained?
The
I mean, we don't know if you don't have the CPS records with.
Right. According to what the court recounted, it was an unsubstantiated
we take that as testimony. Yeah.
Correct. Now, I don't think there's any dispute that the district court can consider matters in camera and rely on those matters as part of its findings and conclusions in the case. I think that's what we have with the interview, because it was a stipulated interview, no request to record.
But at the time of the stipulation, there was nothing on the table that procedurally suggested mother's rights were going to be diminished or changed in any fashion other than her child support rights, correct?
Well, that originally in the motion to change custody when Mr. Geiger was wrongly detained on a probation violation that turned out to be all just a big misunderstanding, Ms. Gordon did move to change custody, and there was no request by Mr. Geiger to change anything else.
So, but procedurally, then, you frame up what are the issues going on, and you have...
Well, I think also in the context of the motion, that's correct, but in the context of the case, what you have is a prior order from the district court specifically on this issue saying, Matsy, the boyfriend at the time, who's apparently now the husband, is not allowed to discipline the children, he's not allowed to hit them, and they're not allowed to
run. Those dates, that grew out of the evidentiary hearing in October, did it not?
It predates.
It does, okay.
This is a 2011 order, which was discussed on the record when the court stated its findings about the interview and its concerns. The court said specifically, I entered an order previously on this issue in 2011 that he wasn't to be disciplining the kids, that the kids weren't to be wrestling, and during the interview, it concerns me that the child said, one, he's still being required to wrestle, and two, the step for the boyfriend is still disciplining the kid and is punching him in the stomach.
But, so, but the interview was not set up to address those issues, or was it? Was it known when the kids were interviewed, before the kids were interviewed, that the court wanted to go into those issues?
All that was said on the interview was after the court set the evidentiary hearing, the trial court, and I'm paraphrasing, said, I've interviewed these children before in relation to other proceedings. I'm inclined to interview them again. And then she brought up the point, I can interview them or I can have someone from the Family Mediation Center interview. And Mr. Geiger's attorney at the time said, we have no objection to the interview. Ms. Gordon, who was pro se at the time, stood up and said, I have no objection to the interview. You interviewed them before. They like you. They'll be excited to hear it. All things to indicate that this interview was acceptable. There was no question to say, well, will I be there? Will it be recorded? I'd like to have it go this way. I'm concerned about this interview process. It was a total and complete
issue. The issue that was on the table was the written motion issue at that point. There was no hint that there was some larger issue.
It was limited to the evidentiary hearing and the issues between the allegations between the parents about the wrongful jailing and whether Ms. Gordon had any role to play in that.
Yeah.
So with that in mind, do you think it's proper for the court sua sponte when they're modify the decree regarding the custody and visitation issues when that type of motion hasn't been properly noticed and brought up before the court?
I think it is because what we're talking about here is one, an order saying these kids aren't to be left alone with the boyfriend without you there in the protective capacity.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one order that has nothing to do with custody or visitation and it relates to a prior order. Then you have the second order, which increases Mr. Geiger's visitation by a net amount of 6 weekends. Because in the same hearing, the judge said, you know, there was complaints on the record by Ms. Gordon that Mr. Geiger was not allowing the children or the older child to travel with the traveling band because he was traveling on weekends that was his time. And the judge said, you know what, if he's going to travel with his band, you're not to stop him because it's on your time. That's just tough. You'll lose that time because it's what's best for the kids.
But counsel, let's go back to the issue before the court. The issue is mother's request as to custody. Could the court have not just denied her motion, dealt with the issue as to supervision of her boyfriend, and been done with it on that occasion based on what was before the court?
Well, the court did deny the motion first, because the timeline of this is the evidentiary hearing, the judge moved to make...
But in the middle of that, we get an oral motion to change father's custody without notice, without a motion to the court,
well,
a written motion to the court?
Well, it wasn't a change in custody to that extent, because...
It was, in fact, a change of custody in terms of the number of days or weekends.
Correct. Now, I think your point is well understood and well made, and it's the same exact thing that the district court said at the district court level.
But was that issue properly, and that's the question, was that issue properly before the court on this occasion?
It was properly before the court because it was not a substantial modification or a change in a fundamental right. It's not like
The number of days is not a right?
No. When you talk about a substantial right or a substantial change in custody, we're concerned with due process. Due process is a two-step inquiry. Threshold question is, are we talking about a substantial or fundamental right?
And if you're going to change an order, isn't notice an opportunity important?
Yes, Your Honor, I do think that notice and opportunity to be heard is important. And I think there's a sliding scale of importance when we're talking about very significant changes, very substantial changes, versus minor changes like a weekend here or there so the oldest child can travel with the band. Or
I think the order kind of read, he gets 4 weekends, and oh, by the way, if there's a fifth weekend, she gets those.
Correct, but he already had...
Kind of a strange order, but...
He already had 3 weekends per month, and she just increased it, which, by the way, it had been steadily increasing over time. The judge increased it...
But that was not before the court.
It was not before the court in the motion. That's correct.
So was there an oral motion? Because Rule 7B would... And the rules of civil procedure ostensibly apply to the family courts as well as the civil courts, the business courts, and so forth. It says, an application to the court for an order shall be by motion, which, unless made during the hearing or trial, shall be made in writing. So I guess you can orally make a motion during the course of the hearing, depending on how important it is. Is that what you're arguing? You're saying this is a minor change and therefore was appropriately requested orally?
Correct. I think that's exactly what happened here, because what happened was that in the pre-evidentiary hearing brief, after Mr. Geiger had learned of the CPS investigation, he raised the issue in that brief and put Ms. Geiger on notice, who was aware of the investigation and the reports and had been privy to the knowledge of that process, and it asked the court to get into that at the evidentiary hearing. A week later, when they go to the evidentiary hearing, the court announces the findings and her review of the CPS records after denying the motion to change custody. And at that time, she brings up the punching, and Mr. Geiger learns of it for the first time. And there's argument. And Mr. Geiger's attorney recognized that we're not asking for a change in physical custody or a significant change. And the district court acknowledged it too. The court specifically stated, I'm not sure how much weight I should give to this interview. I'm not sure how much weight I should put on the CPS records, but if something is there, and I'm going to enter these orders to protect the children to the best that I can, I see fit based on the record.
How could this process be improved, though? For appellate review purposes, this is very challenging. We do not have the CPS order. We do not have a record of what the child said and how the questions were articulated to the child. And we have no written motion with no attachment. So we're...
I agree. I understand what you're saying. And I think it has been addressed.
In 16250?
Yes, Your Honor. But even if you look at that rule, it specifically states that nothing prevents you from waiving these requirements. Still, even with the clarification we have today in NRSPC...
Sure 50 can be waived and then use it in evidence with no record of it.
Well, the Rule 16 procedures, to address what you just stated your concerns were, those provide the procedures to make sure we don't have similar issues like this, but even still, they can be waived. So in other words, you don't need to have all those procedures in place if everyone stipulates to it, and that's what we have here.
The problem is that the report was, that the interview went beyond the bounds of what anyone would have thought they were stipulating to. At least that's what it looks like.
I would close with this, that even if you want to say the interview was wrong and we can't even consider the fact that it occurred, you still have the CPS records as substantial evidence to support
the report. But they're not in the record.
And to that, I will cite you to NRS 432B, subsection 432B.290, subsection E. which basically says that these CPS records are highly confidential. They're not to be, they're allowed to be provided to courts. They're not to be admitted in the courts, and they're supposed to be provided for in-camera review, which is exactly what happened here, unless the court finds that public disclosure is absolutely necessary for the issue before it.
But they're not part of the record here.
And the court did not determine that that public disclosure was absolutely necessary, but she reviewed the records in camera, she provided them to both parties' attorneys, allowed them to look at the records, and if they wanted to make any objection to say, hey, we think this is critical, it should be admitted in the record.
But counsel, didn't the judge on the opening in the record after they objected that CPS had not gone forward with this, basically say, I don't care what CPS did, I think this is...
To the effect of that the CPS investigation was instigated by the Maxey's ex-wife.
I guess related to the concern is, as a substantial evidence, as Justice Pickering is inquiring, well, we don't have in the record the admission of the record, admission of the synopsis of that record. We just have this paraphrasing of things.
We do have the
We have testimony of children not under oath, as the best of our knowledge, because there's no record. So the question is, and I'll give you an opportunity, what is the substantial evidence that has been admitted and is on the record that the judge used?
Well, it's no different than any other document, privileged, confidential, that the court might consider in camera.
Substantial evidence on the record that's been admitted that can be used.
And the court can review documents in camera and state those findings on the record. And if there's no objection to the judge going forward with that, then it's waived. You can't not ask to preserve something and then come here and say the judge should have done
Isn't
it and I never asked.
Isn't that a request for reconsideration or new trial to affect their objection to what occurred?
No, it doesn't, Your Honor, because the horse is already out of the barn. If you stipulate to the admission of a document and then the document doesn't help you, you can't object to it.
But did counsel stipulate to any document?
Counsel stipulated to the interview for the court to consider the interview and make a decision based on that, and that's what happened in this case.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all very much.
Chief,
yes.
We have some questions on this side of the bench.
Sorry.
I think Judge Stiglitz had a question, and then I do.
Mr. Pepperman, what meaningful opportunity did Ms. Gordon have to even participate in addressing these allegations?
Well, she was given notice in the evidentiary hearing brief that there was a CPS investigation and that the father was interested in learning what was going on with that. Then, before the hearing, the judge disclosed the CPS records to both counsel and said, here, this is what I'm looking at, this is what it says, here are my concerns. They were given an opportunity on the record to address those allegations, to object to the CPS records, to object to the statements, the court's reliance on the CPS records, and none of those objections were made.
How would she have an opportunity to get witnesses, perhaps, to do any other, prepare in any other fashion for that evidence? You're calling it an evidentiary hearing. But what opportunity did Ms. Gordon have meaningfully to put on any evidence to challenge these findings?
Well, she was given an opportunity to address them, similar to an argument on any motion. The concern here is, and it goes back to the substantial or fundamental rights. What are we talking about here? Because we're not talking about any substantial change. If you look at the case law, every case that's cited has to do with a termination of parental rights, a change in physical custody from one parent to another. If that's what happened here, I would concede this point, no question asked. You can't do that sort of substantial change without a notice, opportunity to present evidence. But every time we're going to shift visitation by a couple weekends, it's not a substantial or fundamental right that you're entitled to an evidentiary hearing.
But you are entitled to notice. And it's your contention that this mention in the brief is sufficient to put her on notice to be prepared to present evidence. about CPS that she had not received, correct?
The evidentiary hearing was separate and apart from the issue of the protective orders to not keep the not leave the children alone with the boyfriend and to increase the visitation at, you know, next 6 weekends a year. That was a continuation of a motion that the court had already ruled on and ordered. You cannot, the stepfather cannot be disciplining these kids. The court already entered that order and retains jurisdiction to change it if it learns that it's not following, if the order is not being followed. I don't think there's any, major issue with the court. Gets this information, the court can address it, which the court did at this hearing, was given an opportunity to respond and said, look, I was going to change total custody. I was going to take these kids away from you, but there would be no notice for that. That wouldn't be proper. So what I'm going to do is issue these narrowly tailored orders to address this information that is not a substantial or fundamental change, which is reasonable in light of where we are today and the circumstances and notice in this case.
In the pre-evidentiary hearing brief, former counsel request on behalf of Mr. Geiger specific change in custody, or did that brief simply address a request for information regarding the content of the CPS reports?
It was simply about the content of the CPS reports.
Thank you.
Thank you. Again, thank you all very much.
You had 24 minutes, so I'm going to give Ms. Cowden 4 minutes.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. There's a number of points that Mr. Pepperman raised that I could respond to, but I think probably it's what he closed with that is most important. He just acknowledged that the issues for which the hearing had been set were resolved and were separate from the issues before the court today. Those issues sprung up after the court had already ruled on the hearing. She then, evidence had been taken, it was over. Then she called herself as a witness. NRS 50.055, a judge presiding at the trial shall not testify as a witness. That's what happened here. And that is an error that does not need to be preserved by statute. If the judge is so called to testify, no objection need be made in order to preserve the point. That is clear fundamental error. And that's what happened here. And I think that Mr. Pepperman gives too much credit to the trial judge when he states that the reason she didn't change custody was because she realized there were issues of notice. In fact, if you review the record, you'll see that she didn't change custody because she had even more concerns about Mr. Baggert. So this is a question, and I think when the court adopted 16.215, the court was aware. Family court judges weren't aware of these statutes. They simply didn't know about them. And they took an order from this court to tell them, hey, there's a statute here that you need to listen to. You need to follow. Now, in terms of notice, no, there's no notice. Mr. Pepperman just said that the judge was simply ruling a continuation of an order, which, by the way, the notice is not cited anywhere in the record because most of the orders made by this judge were never reduced to writing. Another issue, perhaps, that maybe the court would like to also adopt a family court ruling that requires the judges to issue orders. I'm just suggesting. I apologize. I'm being disdainful. We're normally practicing this in the family courts. I see a lot of things there that are unusual, to say the least. And I apologize if I just let some sarcasm enter my argument. But if they will have an order that you think is being violated, then the proper thing to do is to bring a motion for contempt. and give notice and allow the parties to prepare and bring their witnesses. That's not what happened here. This was not a continuation of the prior order. This was the judge making a decision based upon interviews. I have no reason to think she had any personal bias here. Conducted the interviews. It appears from the record she felt strongly. I would like to find out what happened here. There's no record. There's no way. Any questions from the court?
So you're saying the antecedent order that Mr. Pepperman alluded to was oral and not written, in which the motzi was not to discipline the children and the child was not to wrestle? Or it's not, we don't have it in the record as a written order?
I'm not familiar with the written order to the effect. I know for certain that the wrestling order was an oral order.
But you're not sure about the antecedent disciplinary one?
Correct, I'm not sure of that. And I know, just to make sure it's clear, the wrestling one was subsequently changed in writing because in a later order, Mr. Bagley was required to take the children to wrestling.
Right.
So that it's apparent that those orders changed. And with that, I submit the matter to the court. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Cowden and Mr. Pepperman, for your extensive arguments in this matter and your briefs. This matter will stand submitted. It will be in recess until 30.